Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 114, The Bizarre History of Clipperton Island. What is it about history which I, and presumably you, as you've chosen to listen to this podcast, find so interesting? It is partially the opportunity to learn about people who lived in very different conditions, and to see how they responded to those conditions. A large part of it is the tantalizing chance to see how we got to where we are today, to understand the events which have shaped our world and our lives. An extension of this is the idea that we can learn from that past, and that this knowledge of how we got here could help us decide where to go next. All of this involves people. Much of the action, which is generally considered to be most interesting when it comes to history, takes place in times and locations where there are lots and lots of people. The conquest of Mexico, for example, or Peru, are often considered the headline events out of what we've covered so far on this podcast, as are the Inca, Maya, and Aztec empires and civilizations which preceded them. These are the events, places, and subjects where the links to the wider world are strongest. They allow us to look not just at the events themselves and all the characters involved and affected by them, but also about how those events affected Spain and Europe. A civilization, time, or place with a large population is also the most similar to the civilizations in which we live today. Sometimes, however, the remotest and seemingly most inconsequential places can generate equally fascinating history, and their very remoteness creates a different set of circumstances, which in turn creates truly odd histories. Today's episode is not about a specific event, but it's rather an overview of a place, which might be about as far from the forefront of the big events in Latin American history as it's possible to get, yet which saw a succession of bizarre occurrences across its history. In fact, it has generated a huge amount of history, considering that it's been uninhabited for most of the time that humans have existed. Its story takes in the first circumnavigation of the globe, the Mexican Revolution, both world wars, and international arbitration overseen by a pope. And a lot more than that has happened there. Because so many people have taken an interest in the island, it has borne several names. It's referred to as Clipperton Island in English, Île de Pascón in French, and the related Isla de Pascón in Spanish. Now this makes researching this episode more difficult. There isn't a huge amount written about it, and what there is might be in one of several languages, using one or another of its names. Plenty of other names have been used to refer to it as well. The island itself looks incredibly beautiful. It's one of those tropical atolls usually found in the central and Asian parts of the Pacific. This is the only one in this third of the ocean. A narrow sliver of land and white sand encircles a lagoon, crowned by palm trees, and barely rising above the waters. It is far from anywhere. The nearest bit of mainland is Acapulco in Mexico, still about 600 miles away. This remoteness, as well as the fact that for a century or two the lagoon has been cut off from the surrounding sea by the ring of the atoll, makes it of interest to biologists and scientists who study birds and fish. Apparently the lagoon water is stagnant, but as we shall see, it is drinkable. And it's also home to unique colonies of bacteria. The island has no indigenous population. So unless some unknown Polynesian navigators reached it and quickly moved on, without leaving a trace, its human history begins with Ferdinand Magellan's circumnavigation of the globe. We did an episode telling that story, which you can find in the back catalogue if you haven't heard it. But working for the Spanish, he and his crew were the first to round the bottom of South America and cross the Pacific. some of them making it back to Spain by rounding Africa. It's hard to confirm these early sightings, but Magellan noted that he had encountered what was probably Clipperton as he began the Pacific leg of his trip, naming it San Pablo, but not going ashore. A few years later, a cousin of Hernán Cortés may have also reached it. He decided to name it Isla Médanos. Like Magellan, he was on his way across the Pacific, so he didn't stop, and the island was largely forgotten about for the next two centuries. It gets its English name from a pirate, John Clipperton, who is said to have used it as a hideout. He roamed the Pacific attacking Spanish ships and ports. He also marooned two sailors on another remote island off Chile, one of whom, Alexander Selkirk, is thought to be the inspiration for Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. Unfortunately, due to the nature of pirates being secretive and operating outside of the law, we don't know much about his time on the island, but he may have expanded a natural set of caves inside the rock which forms the island's most obvious natural feature, so that they could hide if necessary and stash their loot. There are apparently rumours of buried treasure hidden somewhere in those caves. It was the French who came next. A merchant named Michel de Boucage was the first to actually land there, and the first person we can be absolutely 100% sure reached it. This was in 1711, and as he reached it on Good Friday, which falls during the Christian Passiontide festival, he named it Île de la Passion, and claimed it for France. Other sources say that he named it Île de Possession, Possession Island, further confusing things. Around two decades later, the French sent a scientific expedition there, who apparently stayed for a couple of months, but I can't find much about exactly what it was they were doing. So by the time the 1800s came around, Clipperton still had no permanent population, and had been claimed by Spain and France. Arguing that Magellan and or Cortés's cousin had reached it, and that this meant that Spain had rights to the island, when Mexico gained its independence, it asserted that it had inherited this claim. Mexico specifically mentions the island in three different versions of its constitution. The French had other ideas, but this was the era of the French Revolution and the turmoil which followed, so they were a bit busy, and it took 37 years for them to do anything about it. Even then, they didn't do much. They sent a ship to formally take possession of Clipperton, but didn't bother to actually make landfall. By this point, many of the atolls of the Pacific were under French control, and even though Tahiti was thousands of miles away, they announced that the island was now part of Tahitian territory. Despite these arguments about who it belonged to, again the island sat empty for another 40 years. Both France and Mexico were about to find out, however, that it's all very well writing something down on paper. When it comes to international geopolitics, the facts on the ground are what often matters most. And so in 1892, citizens of the rising power of the USA looked at the vacant land and decided they would put it to use. In 1852, Congress had passed an act which said that citizens or corporations would be allowed to take possession of unclaimed islands in order to gather, and I'm not joking, animal excrement. Guano, the waste product of birds and bats, was a big deal at the time. In the 1800s, there were actually two wars fought in South America over it. Okay, there were other factors involved, but I'm not exaggerating when I say that control of remote guano-covered islands were a major cause of these conflicts. Guano is rich in potassium, phosphates, and nitrates, all of which make it excellent fertilizer, and also meant that it could be used to produce gunpowder. A corporation named the Oceanic Phosphate Company applied to take possession of Clipperton under the legislation, but their claim was actually rejected, as the US government recognized France's right to the island. The company went ahead and did it anyway, with 25 or so workers forming Clipperton's first semi-permanent population, or at least the first whose occupation could be measured in years. You could argue that the pirates were the first to actually call it home. Their use of the island seems to have gone largely unnoticed, until a couple of years later they began negotiating to sell their operation to a British company. This brought the situation to the attention of both the French and the Mexicans, and both were outraged. Now you had citizens of not one but two different countries making claims and using what they considered to be their territory, and they hadn't even finished sorting their own arguments out. The French sent strongly worded warnings to the governments of Britain, the USA, and Mexico, in which they reasserted their sovereignty of the island. Then they sent a boat to back this up. There were three American workers present at the time, and as the US government had reassured France that these were private citizens, they had no intention of claiming national sovereignty. The French sailors were satisfied when those workers agreed to lower the American flag. With that done, they left. A Mexican ship turned up a month later, however, and deported the American workers. The government lodged a legal demand for compensation against the American company, arguing that they were owed royalties for the money made on their national territory. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find out what the outcome of this was. They did, however, take over the negotiations with the British company and allowed them to start harvesting guano on Clipperton for a fee. In 1905, 7 years later, Mexico decided that they wanted to solidify their control, and the next bizarre chapter of Clipperton's history began. The island would be settled, and a governor would even be appointed. A military colony was built, alongside a lighthouse, and 10 years later the island's population numbered around 100. The British company appears to have been allowed to continue their work. It wasn't just soldiers and guano harvesters there, though. There were families and children. The governor was a man named Ramon Arnaud. His parents had been French, and he had learnt English, so he possessed the language skills required should anyone try to encroach again. He wasn't enthusiastic about the job. Having been raised in popular central Mexico, the idea of being exiled to a tiny scrap of land, hundreds of miles from anything, wasn't particularly appealing. Apparently the geopolitical importance of Clipperton and its role in disputes between major nations were emphasised to him, and he decided that despite the hardship, it probably was quite a good job after all. Thank you to the sponsor of today's podcast, Warpath. The men of Second Company had their mission, but war is never predictable, and even the best laid plans crumble under the chaos of battle. If you're the kind of person who thrives in that environment and loves tactical decision-making, then you need to check out Warpath, a strategy game that lets you immerse yourself in battles with realistic terrain, sound, and gorgeous visuals. With over 30 million downloads and a 4.6 star rating on iOS, Warpath lets you build the ultimate armory, customizing over 300 units with 1,000 unique modifications, and allowing you to forge real-life weapon parts to upgrade your arsenal. But brute force alone won't win the war. Like the Colonel, you need strategy. Thanks to Warpath's responsive RTS controls, you can use tactical positioning, air support, and flanking maneuvers to outwit your enemy in massive battles. You can employ creative solutions to take out your enemy, by using sniper rifles, for instance. And the best part? You're never out of the fight. Rapid recruitment lets you reinforce your troops when they're in the field, and even if you're defeated, you keep all of your resources. Experience an ever-shifting battlefield with army groups, artillery, flanking, air support, and more in this fun-filled war simulator game. So if you're ready to test your courage, tactics, and mettle against brilliant commanders from around the world, download Warpath today on PC or mobile by using the link in the description. For the first 8 years, though, his initial suspicions were proven to be correct. Nothing happened, and the only thing to break the monotony was the periodic arrival of the supply ship from the mainland. There was no way to produce food on Clipperton, at least enough to support the population, so they were totally reliant on these supplies. Then it all went a bit Lord of the Flies. The ship stopped arriving, and they had no idea why. Unbeknownst to them, the Mexican Revolution had broken out, and to put it bluntly, they had been forgotten about. What's more, the USA had occupied the important port city of Veracruz, for reasons related to the revolution, which are too complicated to get into here. And to top it all off, World War I had just started. They only discovered all of this when an American ship passed by. At this point, many of the inhabitants had already starved to death, or succumbed to scurvy, and the Americans offered to rescue the survivors. This was their only chance to escape, as they did not have a ship of their own. Arnauld refused the offer, however, arguing that all of this made his work defending the Mexican claim to Clipperton even more important. The only islander who left was a German employee of the guano company. This man had played an important role in keeping those who hadn't died alive, planting coconut trees, and thus providing a large part of their meagre diet. By this point, though, he had apparently been driven mad by the conditions. He was the last representative of the company still there, and so their interests in Clipperton ended with him. The story of the ship which had brought the supplies forms another interesting side note to this tale. It had been captured by revolutionaries, and when it encountered a government vessel off the coast of Mazatlan, it was involved in the only naval battle of the revolution. It lost and was sunk. Eventually Arnauld decided that the situation was desperate enough that something had to be done, and perhaps regretted not abandoning the island when he had had the chance. There are two versions of this part of the story. In the first, he set off on a raft with three other men for Acapulco. In the second, another passing American ship ran aground, and his companions were members of its surviving crew. In this version, they used one of the ship's lifeboats, but whether they had a raft or a lifeboat, it was a desperate act, given how much open ocean they had to cross. They didn't make it, and all of them drowned somewhere in the Pacific. Life for the remaining inhabitants had already been horrific, but the darkest part of Clipperton's history was about to begin. There were 15 women and children remaining, and one man, the lighthouse keeper. With nobody there to stop him, he decided to establish himself as a sort of king, ruling over the castaways through fear and force. His reign of terror, lasting almost a year, is said to have been characterized by rape and murder. In the end, two women, one of whom was Arnauld's wife, attacked him with a hammer and put an end to his tyranny. Soon afterwards, another American ship passed by, and they managed to catch its attention and secure their rescue. There were only 4 women and 7 children left. Once again, Clipperton had no human population. Of course, as we've already seen, this didn't mean that arguments about it wouldn't continue. In the 1930s, once the World War and the Mexican Revolution had died down, Mexico and France agreed to an international arbitration so the ownership of the island could finally be resolved. This will not finally resolve the issue. The two countries asked the Pope to judge their claims. He considered it for a while before deciding to pass the issue on to the King of Italy, Victor Emmanuel. He ruled in favour of France, and although the Mexican president investigated the possibility of disputing the result, eventually he agreed to accept the decision. To cement their claim, France stationed a small military force on Clipperton and rebuilt the lighthouse. This only lasted 7 years, however, before the soldiers withdrew, leaving the door open, not for Mexico, but for the USA. Before the French withdrew their garrison, and while serving as president, Franklin D. Roosevelt had ended up making two separate visits to this most remote of islands. It appears that it was his passion for fishing that brought him there. The first time he had been travelling to Hawaii on official business, and this had required going through the Panama Canal and passing close by. He deliberately stopped there, but the weather prevented them from fishing. The second time, he appears to have been on a Latin American Pacific tour with the explicit purpose of fishing. This time he stopped there and caught sharks, before moving on to other parts of the Latin American coastline and ending up in the Galapagos. It was a different time. I can't imagine a sitting president being able to do that today. 10 years later, Roosevelt was still in charge. And of course, the Second World War was in full swing. Remembering the little island, he decided to occupy it so that a weather station could be established to help provide information which could be used to plan operations in the Pacific Theatre. The first ship sent to do this ran aground, and a second one had to come and finish the job. Once established, however, 24 sailors and meteorologists called Clipperton home. Knowing that this was a controversial move, Roosevelt started discussions, first with the Mexicans and then the French. That they would occupy the island for the war was not under discussion, but he seems to have hoped that by recognizing one of the two nations' claims and guaranteeing that the USA would not make any attempt to annex it once the war was over, he might be able to establish a longer-term foothold there. He spoke to the Mexican president first, but then decided that the French were more likely to agree to his proposals. He was very wrong about this. The French were outraged that the island had been occupied to begin with. Tense meetings took place between French and US admirals, and French diplomats stationed in Mexico twice tried to launch secret trips to the island. On the first attempt, they pretended, like Roosevelt, to be going there to fish. On the second, they forged papers, which concealed their true destination. The Americans asked Mexico to stop them leaving the mainland, something the Mexicans were only too happy to do, given their own disagreements with France. At the end of the war, the Americans agreed to pack up and leave, and so today the island remains in French hands, and is once again uninhabited. Mexico still argues that it has the right to fish there, however, and treaties between them and the French recognizing this fact were signed in 2007 and 2017. There are still a few strange epilogues to the story of Clipperton, however. There have been two more sets of castaways. The first came a couple of years after the Americans left, when five Californian fishermen were shipwrecked and stranded there for 6 weeks. The second took place over 23 days in 1962, when nine tuna fishermen were also stranded. They were the ones that reported that the lagoon water was drinkable, and they survived off that, some supplies they'd salvaged from their ship, and the fruit of the coconut trees, which had sustained some of the Mexican colonists 50 years earlier. They built shelters by recycling the wreckage of the World War II military huts. In the 60s, as countries scrambled to obtain and test nuclear bombs, the European powers looked for remote parts of their surviving empires to conduct those tests. The British chose parts of the Australian deserts to do theirs, controversially displacing some of the Aboriginal population to do so. The French went for the Sahara Desert in Algeria, but they seriously considered blowing up Clipperton Island for a while. Instead, they established a small scientific station to measure the impact of all the nuclear testing taking place elsewhere on the Earth's atmosphere. A motley array of people have visited Clipperton in the decades since then. Plenty of scientists have come for short periods of time, particularly those interested in fish and birds. The reef has one of the highest concentration of endemic marine species in the world, over 115. 13 species of bird use the island to breed, and at least 26 others have been spotted there. In 2009, a tropical fish dealer from California travelled to the island to illegally catch Clipperton angelfish, a species only found there. This scarcity makes them valuable among collectors, worth up to $10,000 each at the time, and he transported 52 living specimens back, declaring them to be a related, less rare and not illegal species. He was caught and sentenced to 45 days in prison, a year on probation, and a $2,000 fine. Enthusiasts taking part in legal expeditions also fish in Clipperton's waters occasionally. There is one final, unexpected set of people who like to visit the island. Amateur ham radio fans. I have to admit, I don't really know much about this, but apparently there is an international community of people who really like radio communication, and they enjoy communicating with each other using these radios. Some of them take part in what they call de-expeditions, trips to far-flung places where there is little or no radio traffic to compete with. There are even competitions and awards, some based on contacting the most individual and or the most remotest places over the radio waves. Quite a few of these de-expeditions have gone to Clipperton since the late 70s, the most recent one being this year. Given all the strange history and interesting peoples who have been drawn to Clipperton over the centuries, everyone from pirates to presidents on fishing trips, would-be tyrants, and people hoping to make their fortune collecting animal dung, I shouldn't really be surprised that this latest set of obscure hobbyists have chosen to make their way there. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to do something to help out, one thing which really helps the podcast grow and new people to discover it is leaving a review wherever you get your podcast from. If you'd like to get one special extra episode a month, as well as access to the back catalogue of these special episodes, it's possible to become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to sign up in the episode description. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done one of these things. And thank you to everyone for listening. You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast. Written and produced by me, Max Argent. Edited by Alex McNamara. If you want to become a friend of the podcast and gain access to a bonus episode each month, as well as helping to support the running of the show, there's a link with information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast can also be found on Facebook and Twitter by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. Here, I post updates about new episodes, as well as interesting articles I find about Latin American history. Thank you for listening.